Well, thanks, Ann, for the kind introduction. You lots of things you didn't say. That's just as well. But no, it's on. It's on. It's fine. Yeah. So today's chapter called Spiritual Secularity is something that I bet resonates with a lot of us, because how many of us really believe that there's a strict divide between the sacred and the secular? I don't see too many hands going up, you see. I think we all have this sense that there are awe moments in our everyday lives, and there are inspired moments in our you know, quiet times that transcend the boundaries and cross over willingly from one so-called domain to the other. So the author opens telling us about his dropping into the sacred space of a church in the middle of a busy city. And while he appreciates the peace and quiet of such a venue, he suggests that you can glimpse the sacred in the secular or enjoy worldly life more because of your spiritual vision. He uses this word, spiritual vision. I think a lot of people here at Word and Life have that vision. I just know it. I get that feel. Moore sides with Thoreau in expanding the idea of a sacrament on page 139 and 40, well beyond what ordained clerics might dispense. Taking a sensuous bath, he says, can be sacramental. Going for a walk can be sacramental. So can teaching your kid, or even painting your house, he said. How would you like to hire house painters called the sacramental house painters? Any of these, he says, can be vectors to sacramentality, which is a kind of an outward sign of an inward grace, you know. I think Moore recognizes that we have to bring something to the table, however. He says on page 141, let me quote that, "But the sacramentality in an action doesn't appear automatically. If you're unconscious and have no religion of your own, these actions will remain only secular. The religious imagination and a certain style of behavior make all the difference. So much depends on us. Moore is telling us that we need to seek and find religious mystery, religious resonance in our ordinary lives. He's telling us we've got to look for it. Moore often digresses into music in this and in the next chapter, you may have noticed. He takes an almost mystical pleasure, he says, in practicing his piano. So that's a kind of an experience without words. For him, it seems that instrumental music of the type a piano produces enables him to claim Bach, Mozart, and Chopin as his gurus and his saints. At the end of the chapter, in fact, on page 154 to 56, Moore goes into considerable depth describing Bach's Goldberg Variations. And in the following chapter, on page 174 to 76, he waxes enthusiastic over Glenn Gould's recordings of the Goldberg Variations. We'll come to that musical masterpiece after the break. In fact, what I think I'm going to do is, when we go for the break, about 12, 13 minutes after the break begins, I'm going to come back and start playing this piece of music, which is the Goldberg Variations. And I have an audio system here, which will play it through. And as we do that, I'm going to experience with you something about the structural foundation of it by playing along. You may notice at the bottom of your handout, there's a little line of music. So if you're good and come back here without waiting too long after the break, you can hear this being played while the piano is playing and begin to get an appreciation of just how clever Bach was. It's an amazing thing. So, let's see. On the next page, page 142, Moore puts it another way. We're talking here about finding sacred in the secular. He says, "Your challenge, then, is to create a religion of your own by being secular in a religious way or religious in a secular way." My friend Carol Ann Monzi, who now lives in Oregon, but she scheduled a trip to Santa Barbara to be with us today, has conspired with me to identify, explore, and record a whole album of what we like to call maybe crossover songs or both and songs. We call these this album Secular Songs for Sacred People. The nice thing to know is that you can tell your grandchildren that they can get this on iTunes and download it to their iPods, too. So it's published that way officially.
I think I look a little younger in that picture.
It's a miracle. It's a miracle. So I'm going to invite Carol Ann to give you a few reflections on these songs as we sing them. And then we'll take a break. We'll do a little bit of discussion, too. So hang on, and I'll try to follow the time so we don't get lost.
It's a good thing he's doing that, because I'm very bad at that. I always say that when I'm teaching. You know, I get so caught up in my students that if another one doesn't come in, I'll just keep teaching one student all day long. That's what happens when you love what you do.
I'm going to let you go ahead and introduce this next song, and then we'll just go ahead and try it.
What is sacred? What is secular? In biblical times, there might have been a tendency to draw sharp lines between the two and to lock the sacred away in a holy of holies or some kind of tabernacle. But in our day, we are beginning to see things differently. We are seeing a lot of crossover between sacred and secular. We're hearing talk of God's being much more intimately present in all of creation than was ever imagined. As musicians of faith who have been singing and interpreting the lyrics of popular songs all of our lives, we have discovered that there's a wealth of truly inspired wisdom in many of the most beloved so-called secular songs of the last 100 years. Take, for instance, Try to Remember from the Fantastics, a hugely popular musical from 1960. Do you remember this line? "Deep in December, it's nice to remember. Without a hurt, the heart is hollow." Without a hurt, without a scar, as people of faith, we understand how suffering enables us to feel compassion in our lives. The suffering of childbirth unleashes a special measure of compassion in every mother's heart for her new baby. It's such a fundamental bond that God's love for us is likened to it in Isaiah 49. "Can a woman forget her nursing child or show no compassion for the child of her womb? Even these may forget, yet I will not forget you." Here then is Try to Remember.
Try to remember the kind of September when life was slow and oh so mellow. Try to remember the kind of September when grass was green and grain so yellow. Try to remember the kind of September when you were younger and callow fellow. Try to remember try to remember when life was so tender that no one wept except the willow. Try to remember when life was so tender that dreams were kept beside your pillow. Try to remember when life was so tender that love was an ember about to billow. Try to remember, and if you remember, then remember, although you know the snow will follow. Deep in December, it's nice to remember without a hurt. The heart is hollow. Deep in December, it's nice to remember the fire of September that made you mellow. Deep in December, our hearts should remember and
thanks. I guess you can tell we really enjoy doing this kind of thing. Well, have a seat and I'll just bring you right back shortly, okay? Yeah. More, I got to tell you, I got to keep on the track here. I'm talking about a chapter after all. Moore seems to dwell on the intimate and healthy relationship that can and should exist between the sacred and the secular. On page 144, he writes, "In the realm of art in general, the sacred and the secular inhabit a passageway where the two overlap, sometimes giving you the dizzy feeling of being in two worlds. This two worlds in one sensation helps heal the gap between religion and secularism." And a little later he says, "Confuse the sacred and the secular in your environment." He urges you to do this. "Create a liminal space, neither here nor there. Amelia, it is always in the liminal spaces that the significant things happen. So work at creating liminality. Shock yourself and others by refusing to separate the holy and the profane. See the danger in such a separation and avoid it in every instance. This could be a rule in your own religion, if you are so lucky as to make one of your own." So, with that, I'm going to invite Carol Ann back, and we're going to look at another so-called secular song.
The decade of the 1920s, when Gus Kahn and Isham Jones published It Had to Be You, were wild and crazy. It was the dawn of prohibition. There were speakeasies and talking movies. J. Edgar Hoover was rising and Wall Street was on its way to the great crash of 1929. What intrigues us about the lyric in It Had to Be You is this line: "For nobody else gave me a thrill. With all your faults, I love you still." There are the kinds of words that God could sing to us on any day, on any year in all of history. "With all your faults, dear humans, I love you still." The idea of loving that which is far from perfect is not just a divine prerogative. We humans do it too, and sometimes rather well. A passage in Psalm 145 comes to mind, reminding us of God's enduring love for humankind. The Lord is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and rich in love. The Lord is good to all. He has compassion on all he has made. Here's a glimpse at how this kind of patient love was expressed in a pop song of 1924. And you are welcome to sing along. The words are on your handout. Just let us set the stage with a short musical introduction of It Had to Be You. Gets to do that tuning in public.
Ha, ha.
Singers don't get to do that.
Tough.
It wouldn't be very pretty. Why do I do just as you say? Why must I just give you your way? Why do I sigh? Why do I try to forget? It must have been that something lovers call fate kept on saying I had to wait. I saw them all, just couldn't fall to emerge.
It had to be you.
It had to be you.
It had to be you.
I wandered around and finally found that somebody who could make me be true, could make me be blue, or even be glad, just to be sad. Thinking of you, some others I've seen might never be mean, might never be cross or try to be boss, but they wouldn't do. Good voice there. For nobody else gave me a thrill with all your faults. I love you still. It had to be you, wonderful you. It had to be you.
They did pretty well.
You hardly needed me on that. You all did such a good job.
They must have sung it before.
They must have sung
in a different life. Who knows? So, Mr. Moore, guiding us into the wonderful world of secularity. I think he hits the nail on the head when he writes on page 150, I'm the theologian. I go around looking for the sacred in the secular in order to teach and sustain it. It's my job and the work of poets, he said, theologians and poets, to have the eyesight that grasps the sacred when it appears in the secular. Now, what I'd like to suggest is that we take a 5-minute or so break and share with the person next to you your awareness of how the sacred breaks through in your own life in some situation or other. So please go and talk to your neighbor. Sacred breaking into the secular. Well, I can see you're having fun with your neighbor, sharing your experiences, and this is all collective wisdom, and it's all good. So how about a minute to wind up, and then we'll get on. Well, thank you for indulging yourselves in experience, life experience. It's always a good teacher. I'm going to go ahead and follow into the chapter just a little more. There is something interesting that comes up on page 153 when Thomas More segues into issues of death and resurrection. And let me read you a little bit from that. He says, "Life is phoenix-like, always being born again out of its own death. The true nature of life is resurrection. All life is life after death, second life, reincarnation. The core teachings of Jesus focus on this kind of resurrection, the revelation of a hidden, rich possibility in human life. They are mainly about taking life to a new level, making the crucial shift from plain, unconscious living to an awareness of the depth and vast reach of things, especially living from love rather than unresolved bitterness." Brown refers to this shift as resurrection. Aaron's staff growing flowers. The phoenix rising. Water becoming sweet and pure. In the Gospels, water becomes wine. Yet another natural image for resurrection. Zen masters describe the awakening known as Satori in similar terms. And at the bottom of the page, he says, "The theology of resurrection that we find in several religious traditions is about your resurrection now in this life. Will you remain soul dead, or will you wake up with a spiritual imagination, an appreciation for the sublime? The resurrected person has an open heart and a perceptive mind. When he was soul dead, he was not capable of compassion. Now that he has resurrected, his heart is awake and at work." And so on. So that's a kind of a new spin on, you know, death and resurrection. And let me invite Carol Ann back to explore a little bit of this in another song. Now, not all of our songs, not all of our songs are on your handout. Some of them are solo stuff, and that's the case for this next one, which is The Rose.
Paradoxes can be wonderful seeds for contemplation. Turning conventional wisdom on its head, which is what a paradox often does, occurs in many passages of Scripture. For example, in Luke 14, "For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." And in Matthew 7, "Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured out to you." The Beatitudes themselves, "Blessed are the meek, blessed are the merciful," are nothing if not paradoxes. How amazing it is to find the same kind of topsy-turvy wisdom, you might even call it a resurrection theme, in a popular ballad, Amanda McBroom's hit song of 1979, The Rose, especially in these lines, "It's the one who won't be taken, who cannot seem to give, and the soul afraid of dying that never learns to live." And in these lines, "Just remember in the winter, far beneath the bitter snows, lies the seed that with the sun's love in the spring becomes the rose."
Some say love, it is a river that drowns the tender reed. say, love, it is a razor that leaves your soul to bleed. Some say, love, it is a takes a chance. It's the one who won't be taken, who cannot seem to give, and the soul afraid of dying, that never learns to live. When the night has been too long,
segue into this. Okay.
One of the great paradoxes that we humans have to contend with is the question, why do failure and suffering happen to those who don't deserve it? We would all like God or some force greater than ourselves to intervene when we are desperate for a fix or a cure. Here's an episode from the Hebrew Bible, the book of Job, that speaks to that quandary. When Job's three friends heard about all the troubles that had come upon him, they set out from their homes and met together to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. When they saw him from a distance, they could hardly recognize him. They began to weep aloud, and they tore their robes. They sat on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights. Job's friends gathered around him in his time of need to be there with him. In Irving Berlin's wonderful song about enduring love, Always, the lyricist says something very similar. Days may not be fair. Always, that's when I'll be there. Later, we hear these words, when the things you've planned need a helping hand, I will understand, always. To understand is to stand under, in a certain sense, to support, to ponder, but not necessarily to intervene. Not necessarily to fix a problem that maybe can't be fixed. Here is the song which Irving Berlin expresses his response to this timeless dilemma. And its lyrics are on your handout if you'd like to sing along with us. It's one of the greatest songs of all time.
There's a passage in Shakespeare, one of his plays, I think it's Twelfth Night, where he uses the verb understand in a very literal sense. He says, the actor is saying to another person on stage, "Sir, I do believe my legs understand me better than I understand you." That's a good one, yes. Sounded good.
Yeah.
Come around. Give yourselves a round of applause.
Absolutely.
Well, I think we can squeeze one more song in before the break, shall we? Let's do that.
Okay. After the dark days of World War II in 1947, Lerner and Lowe helped to revive the battered spirit of Great Britain with their musical Brigadoon. It's remembered for its great love song, Almost Like Being in Love. One of its lines expresses a wonderfully universal sentiment, a largesse that's quite beyond the reach of most mortals most of the time. There's a smile on my face for the whole human race. There are echoes of this breadth of love in Scripture, of course. We read in Isaiah 30, for instance, "But the Lord longs to show you his favor. He wants to give you his tender love." Perhaps the most classic expression of God's love for the whole world is in John 3:16. "For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, so that everyone who believes in him may not perish, but have everlasting life." Let's take a moment to enjoy that largesse of love expressed in the hit song, Almost Like Being in Love.
It's in your handout, so you can sing along if you wish.
What a day this has been.
what a rare mood I'm in.
Why, it's almost like being in love. There's a smile on my face for the whole human race. Why, it's almost like being in love. All of the music of life seems to be like a bell that is ringing for me. And from the way that I feel when that bell starts to peal, I could swear I was falling. I could swear I was falling. Why, it's almost like being in love.
Oh, da, 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 da. Let's do it again. Da, 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 da. Why, it's almost like being in love. There's a smile on my face for the whole human race. Why, it's almost like being in love.
All the music of life seems to be like a bell that is ringing just for me. And from the way that I feel when that bell starts to peal, I could swear I was falling. I could swear I was falling. Why, it's almost like being in love.
Thank you, Carolyn. Thank you, choristers. You're all dismissed for a beautiful buffet back there.